Welcome to Online Gods, a podcast about digital cultures in India and beyond. This month, we're talking about nerd politics with John Postill and Galaxy with Sukhdeep Singh. I'm your host, Ian Cook. Has the internet made the world a freer place? Is it inherently free and democratic, or do we have to fight to make it so? And who are the sorts of people who fight to keep the internet open? And who are the sorts of people who have benefited from the new freedoms enabled through the digitalization of communication? We're going to explore these questions in this episode of Online Gods. If you haven't listened before, then you should know that, like always, this podcast is a journey in which we're trying to find out how the digital is changing the public sphere in India and beyond. First of all, we speak to a scholar who works on a topic relating to digital media or politics, and then we speak to a real, live, online god, someone who is using new media in interesting or innovative ways. This month's scholar is John Postill, who will be talking about nerd politics, whilst our online god is Sukhdeep Singh, founder and editor of Galaxy, an online magazine for the LGBTQI community in South Asia. And this podcast, like all the podcasts, is part of a bigger project on digital dignity, which is run by Sahana Udapa out of LMU Munich. And this month, for the first time, me and Sahana are going to be making one of the interviews together, partly because I found myself in Munich for a while earlier this month. So as I mentioned, we're going to do this interview together with John Postill. And John is Senior Lecturer in Communication at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. And he's been working on media anthropology for a very long time. And he has lots of really interesting projects, including research on stuff to do with populism, digital ethnography, social media, and internet activism. Today, we're going to speak mostly about a group he terms techno-political nerds. These are the tech-savvy actors who've become really important political brokers around issues such as data activism, digital rights, and social protest. And some of them have even got involved in formal politics. And he has a really great book on the topic, which is called The Rise of Nerd Politics, Digital Activism and Political Change. It's published by Pluto. I'll put a link to it also on the site, but I recommend you check it out. Anyway, let's listen to Sahana and my interview with John right now. And it gives us great pleasure to welcome John to Online Gods. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So let's jump straight in. You work a lot on what we might want to call nerds. You know, these sort of computer whiz kids that are sitting in their parents' basements, probably failing to have sex with the girls in school they want to, and spotty and asocial. At least that's the impression we get from American movies. And as we all know, we should believe everything we see in the movies. So I'm guessing that's what you found with your research. These were the sort of people involved in nerd politics, right?
Not really, no. that's not at all the case, in fact. I was working, perhaps I should explain what I mean by the nerds I'm working with. Mm-hmm. I was doing research, anthropological research in Spain and Indonesia on a specific type of nerd, i.e. people who are fascinated by the intersection of technology and politics, people who ask themselves questions, for example, about digital democracy, online freedom of expression, digital rights, who work in those kinds of spaces. And to my surprise, a lot of them were not necessarily very young. You know, there were lots of people in their 30s, 40s, even in their 50s. And they come from very different backgrounds. Some are indeed computer nerds, geeks, hackers, and so on. But many of them are not. They come from other backgrounds. They may come, you know, from the arts or humanities. They may have a journalistic background, and or they're actively working as journalists. So they come from different backgrounds. They're not necessarily American. You know, as I said, my work was not in the US. But you're right about the perceptions that we tend to have about technologically minded people, that they're very much colored or shaped by US popular culture and the news media.
Okay, and these are just a bit more about this group. I'm wondering, like, what sort of skill set do they have? What sort of knowledge base then this group you're looking at? Like, what makes them a group for you?
Yeah, I call it more than a group. I call it a social world. I talk in the book about the social world of nerd politics or technopolitics. In Spain, where I did a lot of my work, the word tecnopolítica, technopolitics, is commonly used in these kinds of circles. So the skills, I've summed them up through a very handy, I hope, acronym, a lowercase, acronym with five letters, CLAMP, CLAMP for short. So that stands for computing, law, art, media, and politics. So, as I said earlier, there are quite a number of them with advanced computer skills, but other people come more from a legal background. Others have artists. Then you have those with media skills. And the final set that I found through my research was political skills. When I first started, my assumption was, well, these people are not generally in the formal political system. They are activists. And I didn't think about the political skill set very much until some of them started getting into electoral politics. Some of them actually ended up working for local governments or advising national, international governments. So political skills are very important. And needless to say, politics is more than simply the formal political realm. We all, as we all know, politics is everywhere. So from those who've remained within a civil society space, they also have a political skill. So what we find is that they tend to work in teams. They do a lot of teamwork. I call it a combination of teamwork and crowd work. So in their various campaigns for digital rights, social protests such as the Occupy movement or the Indignadas movement in Spain, they very often combine teamwork in small groups, in small teams, with rallying a crowd around them through techniques such as crowdfunding or crowdsourcing.
Interesting. And is there something particular that these this social world, a certain type of politics that they get involved in, or a certain broad political stance, or can it be anything?
When I first started researching this world back in 2010, the people I was working with, a small group of activists in Barcelona, were operating within the space of digital rights, internet freedom, campaigning against legislation that they saw as limiting people's ability to do things online. So initially, my first mapping of this world was digital rights. But then I started thinking about it more and doing more research, and I ended up suggesting that there are four main domains of political action, namely digital rights, data activism, social protest, and formal politics. Formal politics is a more recent one. But those four domains, I would argue, are the main spheres of action. And it's quite fascinating to follow the trajectory of some of these activists, how they, depending on where you go and do your research, at different points in history, you'll find them operating in a different domain.
Right. I think I'll just jump in here, John. In your book, you've suggested that technopole nerds have a kind of pro-democracy stance, and they have a profound dislike for authoritarianism. And you also tell us that we see this passion translating into digital rights and data activism. And you've now just described the four different domains. But studies are also telling us that the very language of freedom of expression and data rights is today paraded to justify online speech that is cozying up with far-right movements in North America and Europe. In fact, there are arguments that trolling as subversive speech and technological incivility was all about speaking against the authorities. But now it's also becoming the language of the right wing. For instance, in India, we see that there's a kind of symbolic prominence of tech modernity, right? And that's combining with new forms of belligerent nationalism online. And of course, although there is tech activism that's directly condemning it, and there is also this discourse around anti-corruption, which is common to all these groups. In this sense, how can we say nerd politics as doing one thing and not the other? In other words, how can we keep history away from this analysis?
That's a very good point. Well, my analysis is historical. I go back to the 1980s and bring it up to the present day. But I do clarify, in fact, a reader of the first, one of the final, I should say, final drafts of the book, of the manuscript, someone made the comment, you know, what about the alt-right? What about all these nerds who have computer skills and other skills and are not pro-democracy? And that's a very important question. But what I explain in the book is that the focus of my research was on pro-democracy nerds. So the actual term is a bit of a mouthful, but the people I'm actually working with, I'm writing about in the book, are pro-democracy technopolitical nerds. They're not technopolitical nerds in general. So it'd be great to have a companion volume if I ever get round to doing some more research on this. It'd be great to have a companion volume looking at those technopolitical nerds who are anti-democracy or pro-authoritarian. But that would be a separate study.
But would you get a sense that all these groups are using similar tactics?
I wouldn't really know. I haven't done enough. I haven't done proper research on these other groups. But I wouldn't be surprised from my superficial knowledge of those other groups. Yes, I'm not surprised that they will use a very old notion such as freedom has been used for a very long time for very different political purposes. So it's not surprising that those who espouse racist or xenophobic ideals will also adopt the language of freedom or, you know, defending their people against aggression. I don't find that surprising.
And my other question is about the agency of these actors, right? I mean, the kind of politics they do is one question, but also there is the assumption that these nerds can in fact create a change in the discourse because they know the technology, they know how to navigate online environments, etc. But with this, with the growth of algorithmic politics and artificial intelligence, I was just reading the article you forwarded just this morning to all of us. So with this, you know, kind of influence of artificial intelligence and algorithmic politics, do you think their agency will become curtailed or overpowered? So nerds can no longer do what they used to do before.
This is another really important question. Again, I won't have a good answer for, but I think it's something that they themselves are following very closely. They are acquiring these kinds of skills as well and debating precisely, you know, what do we mean by algorithms? How much can we actually understand the effects of these algorithms? Some of them are looking at the question of moral panics. Are we panicking too much around algorithms? I think the same sorts of struggles will continue because these struggles are not merely technological. These struggles will entail the same or similar types of political actors saying we need to legislate against certain uses of these technologies. We need to limit, for example, the power of Silicon Valley corporations to have access to people's private data, allow people to, for example, move their data freely from one platform to the other. So I think the the technology will definitely change, the debates will move, but at the heart of the debates will still be these political ideals, and the terrain will continue to change rapidly, but I don't think the political ideals will change that much.
Right. You know, these questions are quite common among communication scholars, political scientists, and they have a certain way of studying them. But as anthropologists, how can we actually capture this? And how have you done it in your work? Because ethnography, as we know, is now reinvented. We are now retooling it to understand digital media and practices, the kinds that ethnography was not traditionally or institutionally prepared to study. You have written extensively about internet-related ethnography, to combine offline and online research. So my question would be, what kind of ethnography did you develop while studying nerd politics? And as we move ahead, how can we document artificial intelligence and other kinds of influences? And how did ethnography as a research method help you?
Mm-hmm. My research methods, I'll be doing field work for how long? For over 20, I suppose I started in 95. For the last for a few decades now, I've been doing field work. There's not a huge difference between the type of research that I do now and what I did, say, 10, 15 years ago, in that I tend to follow the old principle of follow your research participants. You become interested in a group, in a scene, in a certain social space, and you get to know people, you hang out with them, you interview them, go to events, and I follow through that. So I'm guided by the people I'm working with. If they say that this particular issue it matters to them, then it matters to me as well. When it becomes technical, I go on the best technical advice that those same research participants are giving me. And what I tend to do is that I gather materials left, right, and center. I through those various methods I mentioned, I do a lot of online work as well as offline. And what happened in Spain during the first 12 months of the research is that things were changing very quickly. And the way I followed events was by saying, okay, these particular digital rights activists, what are they doing now and where are they headed? For example, as they were planning the Indignados movement, as they were co-designing with non-nerds these protests in 2011. Now, on the question of, to me, that applies to technological issues as well. There's only so much technological expertise we can acquire as anthropologists, unless that your particular topic is about the technology itself. That wasn't the case in my research. I wasn't really studying technology as such. I was studying certain people who take the intersection of the technological and the political quite seriously. But it will depend on the research project. Research projects demanding, say, for example, you want to understand how programmers work, how free software programmers work. It may help to learn how to program. It may help to some extent without necessarily becoming a virtuoso of that particular practice. So in my case, the whole thing was quite scattered. It wouldn't really have made much sense in my case to become a practitioner of a certain very, you know, constrained set of skills, because I was working across different forms of expertise and I was working across different sites.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. And thanks a lot for this, Jim.
To sum it up, it was quite a messy muddling through process.
That's quite natural for an anthropologist.
Yeah. I'm sure. Hope any like anthropology students listening to this are heartened to hear that it stays messy throughout your whole life as an anthropologist.
Exactly.
So, yeah. As a final question to wrap things up, we think a lot on this podcast because it's part of a wider project about digital dignity. So we think, like, what chances there are for dignified discussions, debates, politics, even online. So I'm wondering, thinking through the sort of activities that the nerds that you worked with, that they did, like, do you think that their sort of activities are in any way shaping the possibilities for dignity online?
Well, it didn't. When you asked me to come on the podcast, I at first didn't quite know how to respond to when I looked at your work on dignity. I was asking myself why the notion of dignity hadn't come up very much during my research. But it seems to me that it's becoming more prominent now. I was looking at recently some of the work being done, for example, by Digital Rights Watch in Australia, and they were part of this last year. They did this Safer Internet Day, where in fact dignity is one of the key words. They say somewhere that people have the right to be treated with respect and dignity. There's also a cities coalition for digital rights that's just been created between Barcelona, New York, and Amsterdam. And again, the notion of dignity is part of a set of ideas around the notion of privacy, the right to privacy. So I get the impression, but again, it wasn't really part of my research, that this question is now being, it's part of a bigger package around digital rights. So what can nerds and those who work with nerds do about this? Well, continue to work in this area, working towards policy changes, working towards raising awareness about the importance of these issues. So I see continuity in that regard as well.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much, John, for this answer and for all your others. It's been really great having you on the podcast.
Thank you so much, John, for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you. It was great. Thanks very much.
I hope you enjoyed listening to John. I think there was loads of really interesting stuff in there, but I was struck by the importance of skills, the skills needed to be a techno-political nerd. Sometimes I think in popular discourse, the internet is presented as some sort of blank canvas that anyone can just go out there and create something. But we know that you actually need a lot of skills really to make something good, to make something effective, and to make something that people can actually relate to. And I think this is actually similar in a way, what I get from speaking a lot of it to the online gods in the second part of the podcast in the last 13 episodes, is that they all have certain skills that have allowed them to use the digital in an interesting or innovative way. And this is certainly true of this month's guest, who is Sukhdeep Singh, and he started the LGBTQI magazine called Galaxy back when he was a student 9 years or so ago. And it's obvious when you look at it, he obviously has a certain skill in writing or in getting writers and editing and in presenting that on a site that really has managed to make this project a success. So Galaxy exists in both English and in Hindi, and it's an online magazine that features news, campaigns, and longer articles for the LGBTQI community in South Asia. But anyway, you don't need to listen to me describe it. Rather, let's hear Sukhdeep himself. It gives me great pleasure to welcome him to the podcast. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Ian, for inviting me, in fact.
No worries. So I'm really happy to speak to you today, just because I was interested in I've been interested in your magazine for a while, because a few people have recommended it to me, and I know a little bit about the story. But I'm wondering, for the benefit of people who don't know, could you tell us, like, what's the history with Galaxy? How did you get to where you are now?
I basically started Galaxy. I started it in 2010, January of 2010. Back then, I was still a student in college. I was studying engineering. And this whole journey has been pretty interesting, like the whole the time period when Galaxy started. So in 2009, basically, 2nd of July 2009, the Delhi High Court had given a verdict where it had said that Section 377, which criminalizes basically non-penovaginal, that is non-heterosexual sexual activity, any kind of basically sexual activity which was which did not involve a penis and a vagina. So that particular section criminalized non-penovaginal sexual activity, was decriminalized. This particular section was mostly used against LGBT people in India, not directly to imprison them, but more as a threat. The police and other people would use it as a threat to blackmail and other things. And back in 2009, India was still not that accepting, for that matter. And the problem in India mostly is that people aren't aware about what homosexuality is, or whether they don't have any kind of knowledge on this topic. So the initial 2-3 months was kind of a difficult period. I didn't face any direct assault or as such on myself in college. But yes, there were a lot of people who'd come to me telling that, you are probably just confused, or you should have sex with a girl and you'd be okay, you should get cured and all those things. So once things died down, I then felt like I should be writing. I had so much to write about, and also as a young person who was dealing with his own sexuality, exploring his own sexuality, I also wanted to kind of read what other people felt, or how they came out. During those years, while growing up, I remember there were various online forums which I would kind of turn to read the experience of people over there. And so I always wanted to have kind of a resource or a magazine, gay magazine, even in India, which one could read and get all their knowledge and information from. So then I started looking for a platform or a magazine of that kind where I could basically write and share my views, my experiences and other things. But what I found was, back then there weren't any such magazines. I had come across one or two magazines, online magazines in India that had just very recently started. But I wasn't pretty happy with the kind of content they had. So that's when I thought, why not start something on my own? Because in my college, during my college years, I was also involved in running a college newsletter. So I had kind of gained an experience in news writing, editing, or designing and other things. And then I started sharing links on some of the online forums, and then people kind of liked it very much. I started receiving really good supportive messages. There were people who wanted to write for it. And even in my college, when my friends got to know, they had a look at it, they were pretty supportive. And by the next month, my friend said, you should get a website. And we had our own website, and more people started writing it. And then slowly, from 20 pages issue, we kind of moved to almost 60-70 pages. Over the years, as the magazine kind of grew, what I found was people were also had more expectations from the magazine, and running just a monthly or a bi-monthly magazine wasn't exactly fitting the agenda that I had or the vision that I had. And so then we started also covering news as in the day-to-day news, or any activities that were happening, LGBTQ news, which included events, pride marches, other things. And after almost running it as a magazine for 3 years, I decided it is better to have a website where we can put up articles daily. It was also based on the kind of feedback that I was getting and the behavior of users, because people wanted to share individual articles on social media, and having a PDF wasn't exactly very comfortable reading it on the mobile. So then we kind of ditched the magazine forward format and moved it online as a website. And over the years, we have added various sections, news. We are now also a very trustable news resource related to LGBTQ issues. And we cover not just India, but also the whole of South Asia.
When I was looking through your magazine in preparation for this interview this week, I was thinking as was about my own growing up and about people I knew from when I was young. And I'm from a small town in northern England, and it was maybe because it's a small place, at least as a teenager growing up until I left when I was in my when I was 18, I don't think I ever knew a single person who came out, because we lived in a small town. And then like years later, if I bumped into people from my hometown, you know, in large cities and so on, I'd ask them, I don't see you around, you know, our hometown anymore. And they would say something, well, it's not really, you know, I don't really feel very comfortable there and so on. And then I realized, okay, so they came out, but they didn't feel comfortable coming out in such a small place. And I was wondering, I was born in the early 1980s. So this was my growing up was almost a pre-internet age or a very early internet age. So I'm just wondering about the effect of a magazine like Galaxy. I don't know if you get reader feedback and so on from people from small towns where there's not a community, because I imagine in colleges and in big cities you can find a community, but the internet really enables communities to exist in places where people maybe feel quite isolated. So I'm wondering whether have you had any feedback or interaction with your readership about people maybe based away from the centers of, you know, away from Delhi or Mumbai and so on, but in the smaller places?
Yes, and in fact, I mean, you pointed this out very correctly. I have had I've met quite a few people just a few days ago, I was talking to a friend. Before that, I've had people reach out to me for whom the only source of LGBT, the resource of getting to know about LGBT has been Galaxy, especially in the smaller towns. Who have come and told me later that while we were in college, or I mean, Galaxy was our only resource. That was our only way to kind of know that yes, there are other people, and I mean, what are the kind of things or life lead or other such things. So, and especially because we then in 2014 we added a Hindi section, which has been one of our very popular, in fact, sections, because of a very large, especially in smaller towns, not many people are still very comfortable with English, because English is a foreign language for us.
Interesting. And I was just wondering, then it's interesting you mentioned language. I was actually thinking not only about then the difference between Hindi and English, but also in terms of, I'm just imagining then, especially if you've not been in contact with other people in the community and you're searching for such a magazine like Galaxy, or just going into Google and searching for terms. And I'm wondering if a lot of people only know words relating to people's sexuality that are quite crude or offensive, and people search for stuff like that. But I imagine, I don't speak Hindi, but in the sort of the English version of the site, you use basically, you know, the politically correct words, etc. and so on. I'm wondering how do people come across your magazine? You know, I wonder what they have to search for, or how they have to find it to find something like Galaxy.
I mean, I'll just give you some brief about some of the very interesting, because we maintain Google Analytics. I see what kind of things people usually search for. And so one of our very, top hitting keywords is people are searching for gay stories on the internet. So we have a fiction column where people have stories, put in their stories and articles. So many of these articles kind of have these keywords that people are searching. I mean, I did not add those keywords in general because many of the stories that we have published are basically personal experiences where people have written down their own life story or their own journey or their struggles. And it is with these keywords that the articles are now we have completed 9 years. So we have a whole lot of repository of various different kind of articles with various probably different keywords in them that I don't realize mostly.
So just I'm wondering if it's interesting to hear even the short amount, or not so short, 9 years since you've been going, how your magazine has changed as sort of the infrastructure of the internet has changed. So you started off, you know, growing up as somebody who was using forums and blogs, which now almost seem like ancient history in terms of how most people interact with the internet now. And then you stopped being PDF and became totally web-based. But then now in recent years, of course, a lot of conversation, a lot of discussion takes place on on social media, Facebook or Twitter and so on, or Instagram. And I'm wondering, and I'm thinking here specifically about, you know, community, because you're talking very much about your magazine is for a community, and it's a safe space, if you like, you know, that people can come and share stories and share quite personal things. And then Facebook and Twitter, they're somehow almost like sort of brutal open places. And I'm wondering if you notice differences in the type of discussions or interactions that take place on your website versus when you post stories on social media.
So I think with Facebook and Twitter, what has happened is most discussions take place only on Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
People don't take the effort to log into a website, and post their comments there. Although we do have, like, in some of the articles, people do post their comments. But mostly, I think with social media, what happens are people are mostly on social media. So most of the comments come under the links that we share on Facebook and or on Twitter or for that matter, even Instagram. But we have not had that negative. Any kind of a negative reaction to our articles or anything. It's also probably because most of our audience is LGBTQ or those who are kind of already sensitized to LGBTQ issues. And it's also because in these 10 years, the whole conversation around LGBTQ issues in India has changed drastically. I remember when we had just started off in 2010, and like if we were sharing our articles on Twitter or on Facebook, we would receive a barrage of negative comments or trolls attacking us. That has never happened now over the years. Even now when we engage or hold Twitter campaigns so we have never had any kind of a negative or trolling on our page these days. That also kind of points to how the whole conversation has changed over these last 10 years in India, probably.
It's really interesting. And then so I guess, I mean, it's interesting, I suppose you brought in this political aspect to your, I mean, political of a small p, you know, aspect to your magazine. You're also very much interested in trying to affect change in the world, not only represent people's stories. And so I'm wondering, like, what next for you? Like, what do you have in mind as a magazine, like going forward? Do you have like aims or campaigns or things you really want to work on?
So there are obviously a lot of things that I want or we want to work on, but then the other thing is that we don't do it full time. Like I don't do it full time, or any of the writers don't do it full time. Everyone has a job, and we kind of manage this after our job hours. And over the years, now that the magazine has kept on growing, and we kind of have a number of, and not just the magazine, even the whole LGBT scene in India and the South Asia has grown. So it kind of becomes difficult to keep pace and kind of do all the things that I want or we want. So yes, we have had but we try and collaborate with different people or organizations where we can. So just for example, we've held Wikipedia editathons on pride marches on transgender activists, because the Wikipedia information about Indian pride marches was lacking. There were just two or three pages when we started out 2 years back. Apart from that, we have held panel discussions, we have held events in India, we've held workshops in colleges, we've gone to colleges and talked to students over there. One thing I'm like trying to move on to is also have a good YouTube presence, and now we are slowly also building up on our YouTube videos. Where we can again show this positive portrayal on YouTube as well. So, but as I said, we are limited by our resources and our time.
Right, I mean,
so that's one major issue for us. Yeah.
Yes, slightly related to that, but not really. I'm trying to think about sort of the wider sort of shift then, which is going on in all over the world, but especially in South Asia and India, maybe specifically right now, is that so much conversation about belonging, about the nation, about politics, about social life is taking place now online. And one of the things that we're always interested in trying to find out in this podcast, and it's the last question I'll ask you, the last question we ask all our guests, is do you think that the online space is somewhere where we can have a dignified discussion? You know, is it a place for you know, dignified debate to take place?
I think the online space has kind of helped, definitely helped, minorities or marginal communities. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if not widely, but the way, like I'll say I'm the post-internet gay person. Like if I look at the experiences of how people or the hardship that people would face pre-internet days, especially LGBTQ people or marginalized people, I can't even imagine how they overcame this. For the internet and its various communities it has both the flip, it's like two sides of the coin. So I like to see it in a positive way because the anonymity helps, definitely helps, especially when you're closeted. Also, over the internet, it's very easy and convenient for you to find these forums where you can go and reach out to people. You can have a support group, at least some kind of a support group. So, that has been helpful. But we all know the kind of trolling as well and other things, the negative effect as well that the internet is very much capable of. But despite those, I believe, marginalized communities have been able to carve their own safe spaces, whether you look at various, secret groups on Facebook, or whether you look at websites like Galaxy. So I would like to look at it as a more positive, in a more positive way, I'll say.
Okay, thanks. It's good to end on a positive note. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure having you on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thank you for inviting.
All right. Well, I think it was really interesting hearing Sukhdeep recall his 9 years of running Galaxy because, there were sort of two parallel and entwined histories that were going on at the same time that he was sort of moving through. One was the history of gay rights and also, let's say, maybe more broadly, sort of the gay communities. Visibility and ability to be political actors in India, that's on one side, but also changes in the internet at the same time, partly related to these shifts in types of modes of communication from forums through right the way through to today, which is social media dominated, but also in terms of like how he even started as a print magazine. It was so long ago and then very quickly changed how very quickly changed into being something wholly online. So I think it's interesting how these two things entwined in his story. Anyway, that is enough from us. I really hope you've enjoyed the show. If you want to contact me, then you can drop me a line on Twitter. I am Ian Mick Cook. Or you can drop us an email, onlinegodspodcast@gmail.com, or you can find us on our website, which is For Digital Dignity, FOR, or you can find us on Facebook, which is For Digital Dignity with the number. Anyway, please do get in touch and rate us and all those things. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Ta-ra! Thank you so much for listening to the Online Gods podcast. Online Gods is part of the project Online ARPOL, funded by the European Research Council, starting grant agreement number 714285. The project's PI is Sahan Udapa, who's Professor of Media Anthropology at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology, Ludwig Maximilian University, Munich, Germany. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Goodbye.